But very likely what we create is the digested, reformulated reality pattern of bits and pieces of everything that you've heard, everything that you've known, things that have come into your eyes and ears and nose, and so forth.
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Joe Binetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan. In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Crania Project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. In this episode, we're joined by a very special guest, Stephen Nachmanovich. Stephen is a world-renowned musician. He's an author, computer artist, and also an educator. He's particular passion in the area of improvisational music, specifically in the area of violin. He teaches and writes about improvisation, creativity, and systems thinking across many different domains. Two of his most internationally renowned books are called Free Play and The Art of Is. Stephen studied at Harvard University and the University of California, Santa Cruz, where he earned a PhD in the history of consciousness. So, Stephen Nachmanovich, thank you so much for joining our podcast series. It's great to have you on board. Just to start off, would you perhaps give us some background about yourself and your interest and passion for creativity? And I know your passion for music, obviously.
Currently I'm sitting on a swivel chair, but that is kind of a metaphor for my life, because I have been swiveling throughout my life between the creative arts, the performing arts, philosophy, education. I began my academic career in anthropology and psychology. Even before that, I studied biology. The first thing I published was an article in the Journal of Protozoology, believe it or not. And I had been a musician since I was a little kid. I'd learned to play the violin, but I never expected that this would be a career particularly. In my mid-20s, through a number of circumstances, I had stopped playing the violin for a while, and then I took it up again, having discovered improvisation. And I discovered that much as I love composers and much as I love the work of composers, I didn't actually need them anymore. And the technical difficulties that I'd had as a violinist when I was younger disappeared when I improvised. And somewhat into my time as an improvisational violinist living in the San Francisco area, I met Yehudi Menuhin, who urged me to write a book about improvisation, which became Free Play. But of course, the moment I began writing about improvisation, I was no longer writing entirely about music. I was writing about spontaneous creativity of a mechanic who opens the hood of your car to see how the system is working and sees a hole. The educator who looks at a child and sees a whole child, a whole system, a whole group of children. Improvisation and creativity, and I see them as, I don't see them as distinct from each other. Improvisation is just that form of creativity that takes place in the moment, and other forms get stretched out, and we call those compositions, but they're really versions of the same thing. It's always a matter of being aware of interdependence and interconnection. And when Free Play came out and I ended up traveling a great deal, teaching, I was doing a lot of interactive work with groups of musicians, groups of actors, mixed groups of musicians, dancers, and school teachers, groups of doctors, all kinds of groups. And the more I worked with groups of people, and I can't say teaching them to improvise, because of course we all know how to improvise from having been babies. It's a universal experience. I became more and more interested in those interactive, the way people feed off of each other, the way people nourish each other, the way people provide, well, creative experience for each other. And that became the recent book on improvisation and creativity, The Art of Is, which is about interdependency and interaction and the social dimensions of creativity. I was in Ireland about, it was over 20 years ago now. And we had a conference of neuroscientists and linguists and psychologists and people like that. And I was the artist in the group. And we had a series of conferences that were part in Galway and part in Dublin, and one day on Aran Island. And on this day on Aran Island, we were sitting, the group of about 15 of us were sitting in front of the audience behind one of these tables called a panel, I guess. And they asked us, where does creativity come from? And various people, I was at the end of the row, and various people before me mentioned whatever was their favorite part of the brain or various cognitive functions and so forth. And when it got to be my turn, I said, creativity comes from other people. So that's it in a nutshell.
Okay. And I suppose that links directly with what's always our opening question around, for you, what is the one word that you associate with the concept of creativity, or the word that you would use as a point of entry into discussion around creativity? So what might that word be? And why would it be? Is that as a form of awe or frustration or affection, or what might it be?
You got it. You just explained it. You're exactly right.
So multiple meanings.
Well, of course, because meaning is not very important. What's important is expression and activity. I would take with one part of your question, which was when you mentioned the concept of creativity, because to me, creativity is not a concept. It is activity. Creativity is an action.
It's more a phenomenon, as in it's something you engage in.
It's something when you say ah, or mmm, or oh, or grrr, okay, you are expressing yourself But you're not just expressing yourself, you're expressing your 3.5 billion years of organic evolution and all the learning and information that is inherent in those 3.5 billion years by saying grrr, barre, ro, yapa. Okay, so, but creativity is always an action. Very often people are flummoxed by what are called creative blocks, writer's block, etc. What that simply means is that sometimes you're creating, the creativity is non-existent. The only thing that exists is creating. Sometimes you are creating, sometimes you are not creating. If you're not creating, sometimes you're eating, sometimes you're not eating, sometimes you're sleeping, sometimes you're not sleeping. Okay, when you are not eating, you aren't having an eating block. You're just not eating at the moment. When you're eating, you're eating. When you're creating, when you're writing, playing music, drawing, creating your podcast, teaching children, whatever it is that you do, you are creating at that moment. And there's sometimes when you're not creating. And there's sometimes when we crave entertainment, or in other words, we want to just sit back and let somebody else create something and we just enjoy it.
And when you are, so this idea of that creating, obviously the fact you're using the gerund, that it's an action, you know, it's a continuous action process. Can you talk to me a bit about this idea of improvisation and how you embraced the idea of, the act of improvisation? And I mean, and this might sound oxymoronic, but is there a process or a structure to improvisation, or is it literally, you know, there is absolutely no type of framework or protocols or guidelines or anything like that?
Well, in line with what we just said, I'd say there's no such thing as improvisation. There is improvising. Okay. And improvising, I alluded a moment ago to the 3.5 billion years of organic evolution. If we want to pick a smaller time frame than that, there is, if you are a musician, you may have gotten up this morning and heard some music on the radio. And perhaps you liked it, perhaps you didn't like it. But those sounds are part of your consciousness at the moment. There's something that you may be reacting to. If you didn't like the music, if the music made you angry or whatever, it did so because your tastes, or once again, your tasting, your act of tasting the music was rubbing up against the music that you didn't like, was rubbing up against some kind of patterning that is within you that you've acquired by hearing other music in the past. So if you're a musician and you're just sitting here in silence, you have within you all the music you've ever heard. You've had all the music you've ever studied. You've had all the music that you have liked, the music you have disliked, the music that seems to have passed by you and been ignored, but that is all present in some way. So that when you say an improviser is creating ex nihilo from scratch out of nothing, that nothing is a very, very big nothing that's full of so many stories and so much information. And then you add the 3.5 billion years of organic evolution, the patterning of the body, the fact that I have hands and my hands play on an instrument, or I have a voice and the voice, I have a mouth, I have a throat, I have lungs, all of these patterns, which are part of evolution, contribute to how I use the instrument. They contribute to how I speak. So that information going all the way back in enormous quantities, if you wanted to try to quantify that instrument, that information, of course, your mind would be boggled by even contemplating the tiniest fraction of it. So all of that information is the raw material that you are improvising with when in the so-called act of standing up with no plans and no idea of what you're going to do, and you just say, ah.
So would I be, is it fair to say then that this idea of perhaps that, you know, none of us are rasa, you know, we're none of us are an empty vessel, and that even if we might say we're improvising, or we are improvising, but it comes from a place perhaps of some subconsciously drawing upon the well, the reservoir of acquired knowledge and expertise and experiences that we've been through.
Yes, exactly.
And what makes people afraid of improvising or uncomfortable with it, at least?
Right. There's an inherent, it's great that you used uncomfortable, because one of the things that you learn in this activity is to be comfortable being uncomfortable. When I teach improv workshops, people are getting up. I always begin, also when you asked me the first word and I said, ah, okay, we always begin with baby talk, because some people in the group may be incredibly skilled pianists, and some person in the group may be a skilled dancer, and somebody in the group may be a skilled cook, and so forth. And people have all kinds of skills that they've specialized in their lifetimes. But the one creative school that we have all been to is being babies. So we all have the experience of using syllables expressively. We all have the experience of using movement expressively. And in some ways, syllables are so much more interesting than words. And so, but then there's silly syllables. And when people get up in front of a group and act like babies, which is the beginning place, people always get up in front of a group, act like babies, make noise, move together. And then if their violin or their trumpet or their guitar is off to the side of the room, then they can pick it up later and start improvising on their instrument. You're doing some pretty silly stuff in the meantime. And it's inherently embarrassing and inherently uncomfortable, but you learn to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
So does that link with this idea of kind of anti-fragility, insofar as that mean, you know, that in order to maximize our creative potential, in order to be creating in the most authentic way, that we need to embrace the idea of discomfort or ambiguity, of risk taking, of losing face, of getting our ego bruised, perhaps.
Exactly. And I'm 70 years old, so I've had the opportunity to have my ego bruised thousands of times. So you get used to it. And it's actually not so bad, you know, once you've had your ego bruised so many thousands of times, it's a skill like any other, and it turns out to be not so bad. And coming out of that experience, you get to do things that you otherwise might not have been able to do.
So the amalgamation, or the increasing, the large number of, let's say, nano traumas or micro traumas or micro bruises that our egos take over time, they actually help make us stronger or more creative.
Yes, well, they make us stronger and more creative, but it's also, that's not to minimize the bruises, because one of the things that we learn, I mean, this is again something that when I teach these workshops, we're in a kind of, the Greeks talked about the temenos, like this kind of sacred circle or precinct within which it's safe. I mean, this is what a classroom isn't always, but can be, a place where it's safe for people to take risks and interact and learn from each other. So improvising also is an exercise in compassion. The more you have been bruised by these inevitable experiences of life, the more you may be aware that you can bruise others. And the greater conscience you'll have of what that is. In my new book, In the Art of Is, I quote Del Close. He was a guru of improvisational theater and kind of in the comedy world of Chicago. And he was a mentor to many actors that we know of. And he told his students, your job as an improviser is not to come up with clever lines. Your job as an improviser is to make your partner's shitty lines sound good. So to the extent that you have cleverness and skill and the technical chops to play very well and so forth, this really means nothing. What really means something is when your partner does something that is not so great and you come in to support that.
So is the case then that being creative is fundamentally a social phenomenon?
Yeah.
that we can look at it from a cognitive psychology perspective, we can look at it from a neuroscience perspective and neuroplasticity, and put sensors on people's brains and see what part of their brains fire up when they're in the middle of a concerto, but that fundamentally it is a social process.
I believe it is. And even when I gave the example a few minutes ago of all the information that is present when you're improvising, the 3 billion years, the music that you heard yesterday, the conversation that you had yesterday. So even when you are sitting alone in your room writing, and it is a supposedly solitary creative activity, your parents are in there with you. Your friends are in there with you. The people you like are in there with you. The people you don't like are with you. James Joyce wrote in Ulysses about scribbling nameless shamelessnesses about everyone he ever met or knew. And I mean, whether you're making fun of people or honoring them or whatever it is, we are deeply social beings, even when we're alone. I mean, there was Marcel Proust, who was so pathetically introverted, he had to live in a cork-lined room. And if somebody tried to get him to go out to dinner or something like that, he would be terrified. And in that cork-lined room, he wrote 1,000-page novels about society and human interaction and how people affect each other and the look on someone's face affecting the emotion on somebody else's face. So it's interesting. It's interesting. We're alone apart, alone apart. We're together, we're together, we're together. We're indissoluble from the environment.
I think that that concept of, you know, the environment and indissoluble, and it, when you were talking, I was minded of this idea of the concept of ratcheting, that, you know, humans benefit from the fact that, you know, they build upon the experiences, the knowledge sets, the innovations of prior generations. They don't have to reinvent everything from scratch all the time. And also, I think I was minded by, there's a quote by Rumi who says that, you know, you are not a drop in the ocean, you're the entire ocean in a single drop. And so perhaps that entire ocean is these previous experiences and your generations that have gone before you that have ultimately helped shape you and yeah, your being.
Yes. Yes. And then of course there are the moments when you think you've invented something and you haven't. I created one of the art forms I've been fascinated with my entire life is visual music. And I have been for decades, I've been creating visual music pieces where sound waves and color and form affect each other in various ways. I have a lot of those up on my website and on Vimeo channels and so forth. And in the 90s, I wrote a piece of software called Visual Music Tone Painter, which enabled people to play on a keyboard, on a MIDI keyboard, and the gestures of their fingers would of course create sounds on the keyboard, but would also create colored geometries on the screen. And in a public place, it could be a very large screen at museums and that sort of thing. So one part of this, I've always been interested in synesthesia, in the color that you see when you hear a sound or the mixing of sensations, which is often incorrectly described as a condition. It's not a condition, it's the way the human nervous system works. But of course, those of us who might close our eyes, listen to music, and experience some kind of play of colors and forms, each person will see them differently, of course. So in writing a piece of software, I needed to find a way to translate pitch into color, musical pitch into color. And so I had to come up with a formula. So I did. And of course, it was only one formula, but I thought it was pretty interesting. I won't go into the details of it, but I thought it was pretty interesting and pretty clever. And I was very proud of myself for having invented this method. And then a couple of years later, I discovered a book written in 1666 by someone named Isaac Newton. And he thought of it first.
Well, what I would say is that's good company to be in.
Yeah,
you know,
those things that we it's very important to return to some of the first points we made. Sometimes when we think we're being original and we discover that somebody also did it, which of course is a common experience now in the days of the internet. I mean, I can think of any gibberish word I want to call something, and I can Google it and discover that somebody has named some stupid tech company the same gibberish name. Of course, it was said 3,000 years ago in the Old Testament that there's nothing new under the sun. And if you believe that you are only being creative or original or improvising if you do something that's all new, this can be very discouraging. But what interests me about originality, we all took geometry when we were kids in school, and you know, there's the origin of a graph, right, where the x-axis crosses the y-axis, and that's called the origin. And in the human being, the origin is the belly, let's say, or in Japanese and Chinese Taoist and Zen ideas, it's the tanden, which is 2 inches below the belly button. But you digest things. When I talked before about listening to the music that was on the car radio yesterday, or the books that you read 30 years ago, or the book that you read this morning that you liked or didn't like, these are all things that you digest. And when you have digested them completely, they become part of you, so that you are the origin of that which you create. It doesn't mean that that which you create has never existed before in the history of the universe. It's possible that that may be true, but very likely what we create is the digested, reformulated reality pattern of bits and pieces of everything that you've heard, everything that you've known, things that have come into your eyes and ears and nose and so forth.
If we bring it, kind of pair it right back, let's say, to your traditional lecture hall scenario. So you're in, let's say you're an academic and you're in a lecture hall and you're faced with 100, 150, 200 students. In that context, and I know you talked already about things like improvising as a form of having fun, of creating a safe space, I think, of developing compassion and empathy to allow people to express themselves. What type of conditions are required, in your opinion, in order to cultivate and architect an environment and a culture which allows or affords students the opportunity to create?
Well, that's a very, very important question. If you are a mathematics professor and you're teaching calculus, going back to our friend Isaac Newton again, clearly you have already digested a great deal of mathematics, and you're standing up in the class and you're presenting some of what you have digested. But you also need to know what the students in the class can hear, and what do they know, and how do they respond to the words that you use. And this really eliminates the whole concept. There are various things that are now rampant in education, like the syllabus. There is indeed a body of knowledge of calculus. And what do the students need to know at the end of the term? But the pathway that you take through that body of knowledge is going to differ depending on individual circumstances. What kind of language is this particular student or group of students able to relate to? You learn that by observing the students very closely. And even though it may be you at the head of the class standing up and speaking words out of your mouth and drawing things on the blackboard, you still have to be taking in the environment that you're in and responding to it. So when I talked about Del Close's dictum that your job as an improviser is not to come up with clever lines, it's to make your partner's shitty lines sound good, this applies not just to actors on stage. It also applies to teachers, of course.
So it's about developing that communicative competence almost between yourself and your audience, or the idea, I'm a fan of the idea that, you know, in order to get someone's attention, you have to give them yours, so that you have to understand how they learn.
Exactly.
And what is digestible for them, I suppose.
Exactly. Which is why if you're an educator or if you're an academic talking at conferences to other academics, one thing you really must do is delete Microsoft PowerPoint from your computer. Because people who talk with slides are talking to the slides. And it's very, very difficult to be looking at your own slides or being conscious of them, and also be entirely conscious and present to the people that you're talking to and communicating with them. And yes, if you have slides or written notes or something like that, and you've decided the night before that you want to make 15 points during your hour-long talk, if you forget two of them and make only 13 of them, it's actually okay. It's actually okay. And instead of the two that you forgot, there may be two new ones that arise, or 20 new ones that arise from your interaction with the audience or your interaction with the students.
Yeah, I'm because we've done quite a bit, and some of our podcasts, we talk a lot about the power of storytelling as a form of communicating or instilling values, you know, that humans are hardwired for a story. I suppose that goes back to this idea of, you know, where we've come from evolution, from ratcheting, you know, from and how we learn about the world in a safe way, I suppose. And I know there's a book by a chap called Edward Tufte, and he talks about the cognitive style of PowerPoint. And I think they reenact the Gettysburg Address as if it were a PowerPoint presentation with bullet points. And it was a bit less compelling as a PowerPoint presentation.
A bit less compelling.
and tell me, Stephen, so your most recent, obviously, Free Play was a huge, made lots of ripples. You know what I mean? It got a lot of attention and disrupted things in a positive, in the best sense of that term. That your newest book, The Art of Is, what is?
Ah, well, it's really about the three imps: improvising, impermanence, and imperfection, and interdependency. And it's the fruit of all these kinds of interactive activities, teaching activities and performance and things that I've been talking about, realizing that we exist in a network. In South Africa, they have a word, Ubuntu, which is the opposite. In the West, we have Descartes' I think, therefore I am. And Ubuntu is the idea that I have my being through your having your being. And we are interdependent. And this is the idea of ecology. And so the art of is the art of being present in a world which also contains the redwood forest, which also contains the Chernobyls of the world, which also contains human suffering, which also contains the beauty of the Himalayas, which also contains your neighbor, whom you may pass in the street twice a day, but never talk to. But you may share stories that you never get to speak of.
So it's that interdependence, it's that the connection, and I suppose it's some, it's this idea of sustainability as well, by the sounds of it, that, you know, that we are codependent, and as part of this codependence involves embracing the concept of sustainability.
Yeah, well, it's you're sustaining, but you're also constantly changing. My mentor, he was the English anthropologist and philosopher Gregory Bateson. He came out of his father, William Bateson, coined the word genetics, and Gregory came out of the tradition of evolutionary thinking and the Darwins and 19th century biology, and then became an anthropologist and worked in Bali and New Guinea, and then became interested in mental health issues, and then became interested in what he called the ecology of mind, and what are the mental roots in all of us of the ecological crisis that we're living through. And he talked about coevolution, that we can look at the evolution of the horse from those little Eohippus fossils that were like dog-sized horses up through the modern horse. And we can look at the evolution of grass. And one of them is supposedly in the zoology department, and the other is in the botany department. But for example, if you have a lawn, you get a lawnmower whose purpose is to imitate the teeth of the horse in maintaining the grass. And your lawnmower will have a roller in back, which used to be a separate tool called a rolling stone, after which the band the Rolling Stones were named. And this would imitate the hooves of the horse. And then you get a bag of manure to fertilize the grass, and this imitates the rear end of the horse. So the horse and the grass co-evolved. They're interdependent. And when you talk about sustainability, what was actually sustained, the horse evolved and changed over the millions of years past, and the grass evolved and changed over the millions of years past. But what was sustained was a relationship between them.
And that idea, it's really kind of speaks to me about this idea of biomimicry almost, that so much of our technology, so many of our innovations are actually inspired by biology, the things we see around us historically. But you've touched on it, you know, I'm really struck by the gravity or the gravitas that you assign to the social, the connectivity aspect of creativity. And can you talk a bit about this idea of, you know, systems thinking and systems theory and how that relates? Because I know, I mean, recently enough, I came across a very peculiar, very funny story about how I think the UN ended up parachuting cats into Borneo as a result of a prior intervention they'd made to try and get rid of malaria by killing mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes in turn were, they were killed and they were eaten by geckos, and then the cats ate the geckos, but the cats died, and then rats emerged, and so the UN went back and started parachuting in cats, and as an example of systems thinking. So yeah, can you talk to me a bit about how that might relate to creativity?
Oh, well, that's it's a huge question. And of course, it is of global survival interest now, because we are seeing the ecological crises that have been talked about for the last half century. They're now coming to fruition. And so many of our survival systems on planet Earth are starting to fall apart. And you give this kind of humorous example of which is so true, whether the field is ecology or diplomacy or whatever, that attempts to fix things often make them worse. And then you have to fix the fix. And then you have to fix the fix of the fix of the fix, because systems are interrelated. Not only are they interrelated complexly, but they're interrelated at multiple levels, and the multiple levels interact. And sometimes Bateson, back to my teacher, Gregory Bateson, he met Robert Oppenheimer, you know, the physicist who supervised the development of the atomic bomb.
Fermi, and with them, the Italian sign of Fermi, yeah.
Yes. So this was in the 1950s during the Cold War. And Oppenheimer said to Bateson that we and the Russians are headed off a cliff with a positive rate of acceleration and probably a positive rate of change of acceleration. And perhaps the best thing we can do is nothing, is let it, okay? Because the attempts to the people who tried to fix those problems of the Cold War generated what was called realpolitik, with a K on the end of the word, and thought that they could fix the global political situation and the wars and the threats of wars by intervening and putting so-and-so in power here and so-and-so in power in this country. And we know what that led to. It just kept making things worse. Now, it's much harder to let a system settle down. Another systems thinker, Stafford Beer, talked about the, he was involved in big business, but also politics, consulting in the 1950s, 60s, early 70s, the image of the pendulum, that a pendulum, if it's swinging back and forth, and you try to get it to swing in another way by pushing it this way, what you're going to do is have crazier and crazier movement. Then it's swinging this other crazy way, and then you try to, okay, let's impact it this way. Let's have all these rational plans to fix it. And the thing that you need to do is actually allow the pendulum to slow down and come to a stop. And then you can just poke it once with your finger and it'll start swinging in a reasonable way again. So allowing the pendulum to stop, I mean, this is also a metaphor for meditative practice, to sit and do nothing. I mean, it's kind of funny because we've talked in this hour about people standing up and doing gibberish and baby talk, or giving lectures about calculus, or performing on stage as musicians and actors. But another part of this story is the contemplative act of sitting still and doing nothing, and just allowing the pendulum of your breath to stabilize.
Which is difficult.
Which is very difficult. It's very challenging, because the as you allow that pendulum to stabilize, you become more and more aware of the complexity of the system of which you're part. Most forms of meditation involve some act of watching your breath. And the more you think about your breath, the more you're aware of it, the more complex it is, and the more it involves really the entire universe around you.
So it's actually a systems process.
Yeah, so doing nothing is one of the most important aspects of knowing about systems.
And that's where I suppose the law of unintended consequences very often emerges, when people intervene in a system without considering the ramifications or the ripple effect that might emerge from such an intervention. Can I ask you briefly around, because, you know, as we've spoken about the importance of systems, the importance of connectivity, the importance of the social element of creativity, do you think then that, let's say, in the case of the United States of America, where, you know, one of the dominant value systems in society would be individualism, do you think that value system is at odds with a culture of creativity, or can they be reconciled?
Well, in a healthy society, reconcile implies that you, the word reconcile implies that you find a happy medium between the individual and the collective, and you reside there. But back to our pendulum, the healthy society really, or the healthy life for the individual in society, is to have your individual capacities and have your social capacities, and have your individual capacities, and have your social capacities, and to be that pendulum that swings and is capable of being alone and capable of being with other people. In America, the idea of the, or the idea or the ideal or the stereotype of the individual going it alone. Well, first of all, that's nonsense, because as we know, a person who owns a business is using public roads that were built by other people, and they're using workers who were educated by other people, and so forth. The interconnections are infinite. I could spend hours listing them. But very often it's used as a pretext, the ideology of individualism. I mean, I think it's very important for people to know themselves and be themselves and be capable of being alone and be capable of oscillating between being alone and being with other people. But I'd say the ideology of individualism is often used as a pretext for political domination by a set of those who would be masters.
I understand. And as we come to, I suppose, the close, and I could talk to you all day about your ideas, and it's so interesting. But, you know, if I can reflect a bit on what we've been talking about in the context of trying to foster creativity, or creating, as we were talking about, I know you're a big fan of the gerund as opposed to nouns by the sounds of it. And we've talked about the importance of the group, of the social element, but equally recognizing that there's an individual aspect to it also. The idea of creating an environment that is safe for people to take risks, that is compassionate and empathetic, as an educator, but also, I suppose, as peers, as students' peers as well. That's an environment that allows for play and exploration, and that it recognizes the importance of a broader system within which this particular body of knowledge, or in which this particular skill set resides. And then also the idea that of being a compelling communicator in how we connect with our students, so that they combined, those variables or elements or components combined, can help be the building blocks for a culture of that fosters creating amongst the students. And so if you had a magic wand, we always finish with the same question, were you to have a magic wand, what changes would you like to implement in particularly, let's say, higher education environments to try and foster this culture we've been talking about?
Well, to just mention one change, I would really urge that there be no departments. Now, of course, that's not completely feasible, because there's a reason why the physicists would want to talk to other physicists, and the chemists would want to talk to other chemists, and the historians of medieval English literature would want to talk to other historians of medieval English literature. But it is also important for the physicists and the students of medieval English literature to talk to each other. And a university where departments or schools are somewhat less important would be quite interesting. Before we started talking, I recommended that you speak to a friend of mine, Louise Lowings, who runs a nursery school in the Midlands in England, part of the Reggio Emilia idea. So these are, of course, children who are 2, 3, 4 years old. And instead of, okay, at 10 o'clock, we'll have math and the teacher with the blocks and the numbers on the blocks and so forth. And at 11 o'clock, we'll have science and the teacher with the microscope. And at noon, we'll have physical education and play in the playground. It's one enormous room or set of rooms that are all open to each other. And here's the teacher with the microscope with a USB projector so that the kids can watch worms wiggling around under the microscope. And here's the math teacher with the blocks and the numbers. And there's the playground out there. And here's the storytelling circle. And the teachers are just there. And the kids wander around, so that one child may walk up to the teacher with the microscope and be there for 3 minutes and get bored and walk away and be somewhere else. And another student may walk up to the teacher with the microscope and stay all day because it's so fascinating. Now, in the course of the year, everybody has done everything, but there's no fixed time and there's no fixed department and there's no fixed class period. Now, when I was in graduate school working with Gregory Bateson, it was at the University of California at Santa Cruz in the early 1970s. And that university in the years since has become much more standardized, let's say, though it still bears some element of what it once was, but it had organized itself from its founding in, I think, 1968 as a branch of the enormous University of California system, but in a college system, kind of like Harvard or Oxford, where there were residential colleges. And in the residential colleges would be the faculty office of the historian, of the biologist, of the psychologist, people of all different disciplines in offices next to each other. And the historians and the physicists would still have a committee within their discipline that meets and deals with the issues of that discipline. But students would be exposed to people of many, many disciplines. And the faculty would also be exposed to people, to other faculty of many, many disciplines. And simply this architectural solution of having people with their offices next to each other. I mean, now in a music school, you'll have all of the classical string teachers all in offices next to each other, and the conductors and then the jazz people would probably be in a separate building, you know, just within music. So it's an interesting thing to play with. And there's a lot that you can do just with, I've always felt that architecture is a score for improvisation. And if you just build in a physical design to the space so that people of widely different disciplines are just next to each other doing their thing, and students encountering those teachers encounter each other doing their different things. It would be quite interesting way to run a university.
Absolutely. So I think, so this idea of a built environment that facilitates interdisciplinarity and connections across disciplines. And I suppose if we go back and think about throughout history, some of the most kind of creative hubs in history, like Florence and other cities, where they were points of intersection between different cultures or trade routes. And so at an institutional level, then universities have the opportunity to architect paths of intersection where we have this nexus where creativity emerges at that point of intersection. And also then I think from what you were saying that we allow it to be student-led to a significant degree, that it isn't kind of the sage on the stage prescribing knowledge, we're helping them to identify their passion by exposing them to different things around curiosity and experimentation. And that sounds like a fairly cool educational environment. It's certainly one I think I would like to experience. So Stephen, I think, first of all, I just want to thank you enormously. Once again, it's been such a fascinating, insightful, meandering conversation in the best sense of that term, I hasten to add. I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the Crania podcast today. Your insights, your perspective, your experience is incredibly useful, and we very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It has been really a pleasure to talk with you.